Hi, this is Paul. The timing didn't work out with Nathan Jacobs, so we'll have to have that conversation another time. But I just got back from the American reception. Most everybody was from North America, bumped into one guy who was from Brazil. That was quite interesting. Talked to him a little bit about his project. And this is the end of day one at ARC. Okay, those of you on the membership channel have gotten a bunch of little videos about with some anecdotal things, but when I'm going over this London cable car thing, which is really a delight to get from the hotel to the venue, the cable car is a really cool way to get there. So I've been really enjoying that. Getting a lot of exercise since I've been in Europe, doing a lot of walking. Because I'm dyslexic, usually I can figure out the trains, because that's all straightforward, east and west, and follow the maps. But then when I get out of the station, that's when the trouble starts. And so I wind up taking long walks around London. But you know what? I like to walk, and I like to go new places. And London's a beautiful city, so it's fun to walk around London at night, even when I am lost. And I eventually get myself unlost, and so no harm done. All right, I noticed that the Jordan's speech that he gave is already online in the ARC channel. It'll probably at some point also go on his channel, perhaps. So if you want to get a sense of Jordan's take on this, go ahead and watch that video. I don't think it'll surprise anyone. A conference like this is in some ways sort of like it's sort of like a religious event. And the reason I say that is because the speeches are sort of like sermons. They don't really matter in that you're not going to get a lot of new ideas out of them necessarily. I did pick up some new ideas out of some of the speakers. I got some stuff out of Oz Guinness. A lot of political speeches. Whoa, what happened? Oh. Wow, that's better. I have this little thing and I can control it, and if I hit the wrong one, it obviously zooms in. That'll appear on Grim Grizz's channel. I'll put this down so I don't play with it. But then I can't focus. So a lot of speeches by politicians. They had the former Speaker of the House, who just got voted out. He was there. The present Speaker of the House gave a video talk. Presidential candidate gave a video talk. And so there's a lot of conservative politicians who want to participate in this. And most of those conservative politicians are giving speeches about what the values that this conference has. And so conservative politicians, or any politician, but only the conservatives are here that I've seen, are pretty much trying to find favor and build support. Paul Marshall, I never heard of him before. He gave a speech on energy that I thought was not on energy, but on business and money. I thought that was very even-handed. I really liked his speech. I thought that was the most sort of that was one of the freshest speeches that I heard, and I really enjoyed that one. And I as I confessed on Twitter, there was a panel discussion about economics, and I took a nap in the middle of it, just because I was tired. And so there was, I confess my sins to the video camera. So it's sort of like a religious event in that the reason for the speeches is not so much to give new information or new events, but rather to sort of rally the crowd and create a coalition. And this coalition is sort of between political conservatives and what today we would call classical liberals. And one of the real questions of this conference has to do with liberalism per se. Now, for most of my life, conservative politicians complained about liberals. And even if you go to, let's say, something like Daily Wire, they want to dunk, I drink liberal tears, things like that. But obviously, in the last number of years, the word liberal has changed. And I remember Jordan Peterson fairly early on describing himself as a classical liberal. And so liberal and conservative was sort of progressive and conservative, and then those who identified as liberals eventually became progressives, and then liberals are underneath, and sort of those classical liberal ideas that were derived in the Enlightenment. And a lot of the speeches basically are about going back to liberal ideas. And usually in response to illiberalism on the left, okay? So anti-woke stuff, asking to go back to liberal ideas. And the difficulty with that is that liberalism is not just under assault from the left, but is also under assault from people, religious conservative people, orthodoxy, some very outspoken factions of the Roman Catholic Church, and even some Protestants are increasingly asking questions about liberalism. Now, you can go back to the Tim Keller clip that I play often about how there was procedural liberalism and programmatic liberalism. And I believe it was Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who came up with that distinction. Programmatic liberalism was supposedly a neutral playing field, Basically, one was procedural liberalism was a neutral playing field. Programmatic liberalism was really progressivism. And the WASPy elite that used to sort of control the American political center, as they continued to evolve, as increasingly they sort of shedded off Christianity, some of them became woke, and that sort of split them. And that split in some ways sort of mirrors the split in New Atheism. And so you have sort of Atheism Plus and then, let's say, Classical Atheism. So I'm going to do a talk with Peter Boghossian tomorrow, and James Lindsay was there, so I got to shake his hand. A big part of this is for a whole bunch of us who have been watching YouTube for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, a lot of the people in this Jordan Peterson space are here. And it's a lot of meet and greet time, so you just basically walk up and start meeting these people and start chatting these people. And again, it's not really so much getting into the weeds on ideas. It's much more putting into real flesh some of a little bit of the relationships that have begun online. So at the reception tonight, two people that I saw there and very much went up and introduced myself were Brett Weinstein and Heather Hying. As many of you know, I've made a lot of videos about Brett's work. I've done a lot of critique about Brett, but Brett was completely wonderful. I'm positive about it. It was funny because both of them had sort of the YouTube experience, because they first look at me and they say, "Oh, we've met." I said, "No, we've never met. But oh, I know your voice." And, "Oh, yeah." And they remember who I am. But they were completely lovely, and I was so glad to meet them. A lot of this is sort of meeting people, shaking their hand, and sort of cementing a relationship. That's really, at least for me, what a lot of this is. And then I spent quite a bit of time talking with Nathan Jacob today, so we talked a lot about this liberalism thing, and that's probably what we'll talk about some more. I want to read something. Let's see if I have it on my Kindle or if I have to pull it up on my computer. Eric Torenberg, I read this on the plane flying over from Frankfurt to Heathrow. Aaron Torenberg had a good post on his Substack on group narcissism. Goes over some. No. I'm just signing it. Hang on. So obviously I'm not all set up here to put this on the screen. So I'm just going to read it. You're going to have to listen to it, and I'll put the link to the Substack below. John Cudahy was a sociologist who tried to make sense of how America was unique in its ability to assimilate so many groups so successfully, when so many other regions of the world were caught up in endless ethnic conflict. Cudahy's model was that the United States civil religion, by which he means the religion of civility, has always had high WASP values and virtues, impeccable manners, premium on education, work ethic, etc. And each new generation of immigrants for generations understood that if they wanted to rise to the top of American social hierarchy, they needed to adopt that civil religion, which was to say those WASP values. And this is how the American elite assimilation engine rolled more or less happily for 200 years. But then sometime between the 1950s and the 1970s, the high WASP collective decided to abandon the old rightist aristocratic model and turn into a more progressive model. They kept doing all the same things, sending their kids to Harvard, passing along multi-generational wealth and all the rest, but started believing like there was no different, like they were no different from the rest of society, and downplaying the habits and behaviors that led to their success. Now, this doesn't say here, but I think a lot of that has to do with the counterculture, because the counterculture was it's an ironic populist movement, but was a populist movement that basically shamed the country club people and all of these elite things that only they could have. And remember, the country clubs kept out Catholics and Jews and blacks and all of this WASPy stuff. That's where WASP comes from. And shamed it out of them as basically not in keeping with their egalitarian Protestant Christianity, and rightfully so. But there's a consequence to this. They kept on doing these things, sending their kids to Harvard, passing along multi-generational wealth and all the rest, but started believing they were no different from the rest of society and downplaying the habits and behaviors that led to their success. This is the Machiavelli Pareto model we've discussed, and there's a link to it in the thing. The aristocracy, which once ruled through the confidence, competence, and force, over time denigrates into an oligarchy of manipulation, cunning, and deceit. Now, this is super interesting because one of the panels had Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who, of course, has this very interesting message that she loves to give, that the West should be more confident in its liberalism and enforce it, and basically not, of course, she lives in the Netherlands, not like let all of this Islam that is coming into Western Europe get root. You need to assimilate those people into the core Western values. In order for that to happen, Westerners need to be confident in their values. A lot of the conference is about getting back that confidence. That's what this conference is really about, at least day one so far. I'll read a little bit more from this quote. Pareto called this the aristocracy of lions versus the aristocracy of foxes. Lions are proud, forceful aristocrats who explicitly own their position as leaders. Foxes, however, are humble servants who will forever deny that they're in charge. While lions want to run the world, foxes want to save the world. Because our new elites are foxes and not lions, they no longer feel comfortable celebrating productive habits for the rest of society. And this is the point that I've made often. Donald Trump lives like a libertine. Barack Obama lived like a Puritan. Donald Trump didn't necessarily espouse puritanical values, but many in his entourage would have liked him to. Barack Obama, in many ways, espoused libertine values in the culture, but lived a puritanical life. This is exactly the lion versus foxes dynamic that they're talking about. Our old elites used to share a sense of common responsibility and noblesse oblige, not just to give back, but to expect the masses to act in a way that would let them rise up as well. And you can hear this in Jordan Peterson. So in some ways, Jordan Peterson was a hearkening back to lionly elite in a world where the foxes are practicing what is called manipulation, cunning, and deceit. Old elites knew that on average they had more productive habits than the masses, marital fidelity, two-parent household, steady employment, etc. And so it was their job to provide the masses an example to aspire to. But our elites are less likely to admit they're more productive. If anything, they deny it. While this humility seems generous on the surface, it's nicer to imply that elites are successful solely because of the privilege and not only because they are more productive. This also denies the elites of responsibility to the masses. And this is where you get people like, I'll name names, Gavin Newsom, who is the whitest, most privileged man you could ever find, but he wears woke clothing so that he can just sort of pass, even though you better believe, you know, look at his sons. They're watching Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan. Lions, tigers, and bears, oh my, instead of foxes. And so, in other words, they want to live like lions, but they're sort of lions in fox clothing. I want to pick up something. The ordeal of civility that Cudahy wrote about was this ideal that other groups had to assimilate. The ordeal experienced by various forms of Protestants, Jews, and Catholics through the 1950s is now lost to our cultural memory, but it was a big deal at the time. The modern relevance of Cudahy, who wrote in the 1970s, is that we have inverted the ordeal of civility. Where now the assimilated groups have more to exhibit extreme amounts of civility towards unassimilated groups that have no intention of assimilating. If you listen to the rest of this history, they had a great podcast on the New York City blackouts. And this dynamic was in full view there because on one hand, a whole bunch of regular New Yorkers were like, the police need to get out there and stop the looting and fix this thing up. While the New York Times was writing about, they don't have the same opportunities that we, the editors of the New York Times, has. So the robbing and the looting, that's just understandable given their difficult situation in life. And you watch this play out again and again and again. It's on display in the whole drama around Gaza right now. And so I think this really has a key insight into what's going on. Cudahy introduces his idea of group narcissism and vicarious group narcissism. Group narcissism is when an ethnic group has an exaggerated sense of their own virtues and superiority. When the group's self-image is threatened, it generates a disproportionate response due to narcissistic injury. What's happening here is that we now call COPE, when an objectively worse performing group by outcomes encounters an objectively better performing, I'd work on that objectively thing. Again, I'm increasingly post-liberal, and all that objectively language is very much a piece of the liberal package. The worst performing groups respond nearly all the time is to build a giant edifice of COPE. Yes, everything is the better performing group's fault. It is the privileged group's fault that the underperforming groups are underperforming. One response is archaism. We were once great before we were oppressed. MAGA far right does the same thing. Another response is futurism. We will be great against once we are no longer oppressed. For example, the far left. Cudahy focuses on a form of projection. The worst performing group builds an elaborate theory of how you too, the better performing groups, have deficiencies of the worst performing group. Vicarious group narcissism is when an ethnic group is not allowed to have its own group narcissism and thus exercises the impulse of exhibiting vicarious group narcissism about another unrelated group. This creates additional pathology in the other group. Then he goes on to write it. So, good article. I want to read a little bit of an Aaron Wren piece. This is Aaron Wren's digest. He has different sections on his Substack. This is his digest. Where's the right-wing virtue? Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni dumped her long-term boyfriend after he was captured on tape making lewd comments to several women and apparently attempting to seduce them. By all accounts, it was a fully justifiable decision by Meloni. What I find interesting is that Meloni, who was frequently labeled as far right and has positioned herself as a champion of traditional family values, was not actually married to this man, with whom she had a child and presumably was cohabitating. Now, I've been in Europe and I've actually talked about this, and apparently it's fairly common for Europeans to cohabitate, have children, do all of this, and never bother getting married. That's sort of where Europe is right now. few new right type political figures seem to display personal virtue as would have traditionally been understood. Say what you want about Barack Obama or Mike Pence, but they appear to be faithful husbands and devoted fathers, good family men. The same cannot be said of Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, Corey Lewandowski, etc. I wrote previously about how the advent of the negative world means the end of moral standards, as opposed to ideological ones, in politics. Still, there's something very far off about populist political movements that are supposed to want to return to traditional society, whose leaders don't even want to embrace that in their own lives. As various people have said, this movement increasingly resembles the Jerry Springer Show. So, and I'm not saying anything about anyone here, because, you know, I think Jordan Peterson, for example, continues to model the fact that he is deeply invested in his wife and his marriage. And from what I can see here, that's true in this group too. And so this group, you know, at least the, I'm not going to talk about the politicians that are here, because I don't know. But some of the leaders in this group that I've seen very much seem to want to practice virtue all the way around. And virtue has been a big theme here. Of course, John Anderson from the from Australia, you know, someone who I have a great deal of esteem for, given his personal biography. But again, there's sort of a rolling the clock back. And I think what this movement is going to have to contend with is, while there are two things that seldom lose in politics: fear and nostalgia. And there's a fair amount of fear and nostalgia, not really fear, but sort of, we need to be strong and courageous because things are getting really bad, okay? So they're not afraid, but they're saying we should be afraid because things are getting really bad and we need to seize the moment. And while I enjoyed a lot of what Oz Guinness said today, his civilizational moment, which I thought is an insightful framing of the situation, you're still primarily motivating using fear and nostalgia. Things, member berries, things were good. Things used to be good. There's a reason why liberalism is coming apart. And you're not really going to be, you might be able to mobilize a coalition rapidly using fear and nostalgia. But if your house is showing more and more cracks and you have reason to believe that the foundation is not in order, wishful thinking and paint won't really fix the problem. Modernity is receding for good reason. And I think instead of just having a liberalism that looks back, I think we need to actually do a much better assessment of liberalism in moving forward. I've shared many times my feelings and suspicions about secularism, how secularism was in many ways sort of a Christian smuggling under the world. And many of those assumptions were simply assumed. And now that those are coming apart, you can no longer rely on secularism to sort of carry the day for Christian ideas and values. And this, of course, is sort of behind Tom Holland's and Douglas Murray's question and critique that if actual living Christians are no longer around, will the flower of that faith, meaning the ethics and the modernity, or the ethics and the generosity, will that continue to bloom? And increasingly, events in the world say no. And so, while at least day one, there was a lot of talk about circling the wagons, saving liberalism, going back to liberalism, that won't work. And I think the more religious side of things, which of course this little corner is in, is the right area to really look at, because we have to continue to reassess this. Now, I am the Protestant in the little corner. I think we have a lot to learn from Orthodoxy and Catholicism, but I don't know that we can simply go back, or that, in fact, Orthodox or Catholics themselves simply go back. I'm not always convinced that they're not very aware that they're not just simply going back, but that's another conversation. So, to the degree that this project is just an attempt to reinstantiate the liberalism we had, it will fail. There needs to be the continual process of reevaluating liberalism. The reasons why liberalism is failing are not going to go away. There's a lot to lose with the failure of liberalism that I think we have to really work hard on to not lose in this transition. Part of why liberalism arose was because Christians no longer wanted to fight. And so they could keep implicit a lot of their assumptions and stop killing each other over worldview questions. Now, many of these worldview questions are now upon us, and we can't just dismiss them. And you know, there's a degree of irony with Jordan Peterson's role in this, because on one hand, I think a lot of the reason he sparked a religious revival was that religious, so I've been having conversations with Nathan Jacobs, and Nathan Jacobs is thinking about starting a podcast where he really wants to delve deep into nominalism versus realism. And he sees nominalism, this is not unique to Nathan, a lot of post-liberal Roman Catholic scholars have been beating this drum for a while now, that you can find, if you read Rod Dreher's archives, you can read about this a lot, that not going back to nominalism is the problem. And you can listen to John Vervaeke talk about nominalism. What holds Peterson, Vervaeke, and Peugeot together is they believe that the structures of this world are not arbitrary. And I think a big part of Jordan Peterson's effectiveness as an evangelist was that he was able to convince people deeply that there is a pattern and a structure to this world, and the reason traditional values are the way they are is because of the patterns and structures of this world. And of course, Jonathan Peugeot walks right into that and continues to elaborate it and fill it in with Christian beliefs and Orthodox beliefs. So that's basically what's been happening. But Jordan has always had a degree of ambivalence in his messaging, because sometimes you listen to him and there's structure in the world, and that's why traditional values had what they were. But Jordan is both, I remember Peugeot saying this on Jordan's first talk back from his illness, or maybe he didn't say it, or maybe I said it in the commentary. Jordan always sort of has one feet on both lands. And they're going apart. And at some point, Jordan's going to have to hop. And, you know, this project looks like a doubling down with old modern liberalist coalitions. And fair enough, there's a lot that's been lost about because of the post-liberal left. And most of us watching this channel would agree, the post-liberal left offers no way forward. But liberalism will go away. And I think the question is, how can we save what's good about it and actually address its shortcomings? So hopefully Nathan Jacobs and I will get a chance to make a video and talk more about this. If we don't get a chance to now, I'm sure we'll get a chance to at some point. We had a lot of fun hanging out today, and it was good. So there's my report from the first day of ARC. Wake up early tomorrow morning. Oh, it's 20 after 11. I never get enough sleep these nights. And it all starts again, and then we'll see what happens. So I'll leave a message.